With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, time is running out to submit applications for the trade mission to Colombia. But we start today with another trade mission. Selling more of our U.S. ag products to India is the reason for USDA's trade mission there, which happened earlier this week in New Delhi. C.J. Miller has more.
India is really looking, and we are as well, to find areas that are win-win agriculture.
And that's Alexis Taylor, the Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs for the USDA.
India last year reduced tariffs on almonds, apples, chickpeas, lentils, walnuts, as well as blueberries and cranberries, frozen turkey, and high-quality frozen duck destined for high-end hotels and restaurants, really wanting to capitalize on that additional market access for our producers. USDA estimates that these tariff reductions could expand trade by approximately $345 million this year alone in additional exports.
Taylor adds that those U.S. ag products would be well-suited for India, which is home to more than 1.4 billion people.
Exports of U.S. agricultural products to India were nearly $2 billion last year, making India our 13th largest single country export market. One of the things I think we were really excited about is just some of the demographic changes we're seeing that are causing a really rapidly shifting demand for things like increased protein, more variety of products, and high-value food and agricultural products, things that the United States really excel in or can support and complement their existing agricultural sector here in India.
The USDA has four additional trade missions planned for 2024, with trade trips scheduled for Vancouver, British Columbia in June, Bogota, Colombia in August, Vietnam in mid-September, and Morocco in early December. I'm C.J. Miller.
In other news, the USDA is working to get healthier foods to consumers. Here's Gary Crawford.
Most of us can easily go to our local supermarket and find just about any fresh and healthful food that there is. But in this country today, there are still places where people don't have easy access to fresh, healthy foods, such as fruits and vegetables. However, there is a lot of work going on to change that, work that will also help the farmers who grow those foods. The latest development coming this past week in an announcement from Deputy Agriculture Secretary Social Torres-Small, who told reporters,
USDA Rural Development and the Reinvestment Fund are announcing the selection of 16 partnerships that will receive more than $40 million in grants under the Healthy Food Financing Initiative Partnerships Program to expand access to nutritious and affordable foods in 20 states and in Washington, D.C.
Grants will be used by local organizations to do such things as establishing new local markets and local supply chains and helping local food retailers to offer more fresh produce for their customers. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says this is just part of a huge effort to give consumers more access to healthful foods and to give local farmers more access to nearby markets, an effort that includes
establishing regional food business centers, investing over $300 million in local agricultural marketing initiatives, establishing resources in partnership with states, nearly $700 million invested in states under our regional food system infrastructure effort. We've had local food purchasing agreements where we're creating the opportunity for local opportunities for schools, for food banks to basically sell to a small and mid-sized producer in the region, in the locality, as opposed to a large-scale distributors. We're creating farm-to-school commitments across the board. And finally, we've essentially invested billions of dollars in our procurement efforts as we try to deal with the issue of dealing with food insecurity, encouraging those resources that are going into food banks to come from as much as they can from local and regional food producers.
So people who live in some of the most remote parts of the country don't have to travel so far from home to find fresh, healthy food.
And farmers don't have to ship their products hundreds of miles just to find buyers for those crops. Economists say that our farmers get a much bigger percentage of each dollar that we consumers spend on food when that food is marketed right there in the local area where it's produced. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Susan Littlefield has today's National Spotlight. Here's Susan.
For the most part this growing season, wheat has avoided two major diseases, but a perfect storm is brewing. Hi, I'm Susan Littlefield. I talk with Mark Lubbers. He's a wheat tech product manager with Westbred as we talk about disease outlook, the rains that are coming. But first, where this crop is right now.
Along the Kansas-Oklahoma border, we're just now starting to head out. Some of the earlier maturing varieties are starting to flower. And then as we move up to I-70 in Kansas, we're getting close to into that heading stage, so probably flowering sometime next week. And then as we get into Nebraska, we're getting second node, some of the earlier stuff next week will probably be getting close to flag leaf stage.
Do we have any, well, let's look at the rain perspective first, because there was some this last week. We got more coming in this weekend. We need the rain, but does it bring some concerns with it?
So there's really a couple of questions that I've been getting from farmers here just in the last few days. First of all, everybody's concerned about yield. Well, obviously, we have lost some yield potential overall because of the drier than normal conditions that we've had. But, I'm encouraging growers not to give up hope, because if we do get rain at these key growth stages, we can make up a little bit of yield with kernel weight and kernel size. The second thing that I'm getting is, because of the drier conditions, we haven't seen stripe rust progress as much as I expected it to into Kansas. But now, since we're in that heading, flowering, growth stage time, with this rain that's coming, we kind of have this, this dilemma of, okay, we have rain, which is good, but moisture and cool temperatures also encourage stripe rust development. But because we're at this heading, flowering stage, this is the critical time for Fusarium head blight infection. And so the growers that haven't sprayed for stripe rust, I'm encouraging them to wait, see what materializes with the rainfall that's being forecasted, and maybe switch their fungicide chemicals to a head scab type product if they're concerned about head scab, which typically wheat following corn, those are the type of acres that we want to target for Fusarium head blight or head scab applications.
So I'm sure now is the time that you got to start having those conversations, if you already haven't, Mark, with your crop advisors.
Yeah. So for those fungicide applications, if you have active stripe rust, you absolutely have to spray it. If you don't, I would encourage growers just to sit tight. Let's see what happens weather-wise. For Fusarium head blight or head scab, it's the same disease. There's only a handful of products that are specific for that disease. And so Prosaro, Prosaro Pro, Miravis Ace, those are three commonly used products for Fusarium head blight. And they also control all other fungal diseases. So they'll control stripe rust, leaf rust, etc. The main thing is, for head scab, we want to avoid QOL fungicides, so also known as strobilurins or class 11 fungicides. We want to avoid those at flowering heading time because they have, studies have shown that they can increase the level of vomitoxin that is produced from Fusarium head blight or head scab.
Those comments coming from Mark Lubbers. I'm Susan Littlefield.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's the livestock report. USDA this week announced actions designed to protect our nation's livestock populations from potential H5N1 highly pathogenic avian influenza infection. Rod Bain has more.
What is being done to protect our nation's livestock industry from threats of highly pathogenic H5N1 avian influenza?
We've come together to announce a series of actions.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, speaking with reporters Wednesday, said USDA collaboration with the Centers for Disease Control and Food and Drug Administration has led to actions such as a federal order to take effect Monday, requiring mandatory testing for H5N1 for interstate movement of dairy cattle. Also,
we're issuing a federal order that will require laboratories and state veterinarians to report to the USDA any cattle that test positive for avian flu or any type of influenza A.
The secretary notes the importance of testing due to the emergence of the virus in dairy cattle.
Requiring positive test reporting will help USDA better understand this disease, and testing before interstate movement will limit its spread.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
And here's more from the Agriculture Secretary.
The mandatory testing for interstate movement of dairy cattle involves, prior to interstate movement, dairy cattle will be required to receive a negative test for influenza A virus at an approved National Animal Health Laboratory Network laboratory. Owners of herds in which dairy cows test positive for interstate movement will be required to provide biological information, including animal movement tracing. And dairy cattle that does, in fact, move interstate will have to adhere to the conditions established by APHIS in the guidance that will be published. These steps will be required beginning Monday, but we will focus primarily and specifically on lactating dairy cattle as we initiate this effort.
And the Agriculture Secretary discussed steps in assuring food safety regarding milk, considering the recent cases of H5N1 virus in dairy cattle. Here's Rod Bain once again.
Recent cases of highly pathogenic avian influenza in dairy cattle. What does that mean regarding the ability of consumers to safely consume U.S. milk? Based on available information, according to the Food and Drug Administration and Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack,
our commercial milk supply is safe.
The secretary provided two reasons to reporters Wednesday.
Pasteurization process works, and two, convinced that farmers are working with us to divert any and destroy any milk that may be coming from sick cows.
Secretary Vilsack also notes a recent example of monitoring, testing, and inspection efforts in food safety.
The APHIS and National Veterinary Services Laboratory found H5N1 in a lung tissue sample from an asymptomatic cull dairy cow that originated from an affected herd and was sent to slaughter. The cull dairy cow was condemned by USDA's Food Safety Inspection Service during inspection, indicating that the system is working.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
The Farm Credit Administration Board has received a quarterly report on agriculture's economic status and the farm credit system's financial performance. The report shows that interest rates are high due to unexpected inflation, but Federal Reserve rate cuts may occur later. Despite stable unemployment and economic growth, agricultural producers face tightening margins with declining cash receipts and persistently high input costs. However, cattle producers are benefiting from strong margins, especially cow-calf operations. Risks in the livestock industry include recovering from Texas wildfires and avian influenza outbreaks. The Farm Credit System reported strong financial results with low credit risk and non-performing assets. Though loan growth slowed, earnings increased, but provisions for credit losses rose. Regulatory capital and liquidity levels are healthy, positioning the system to support U.S. farmers and ranchers. The deadline to apply for an upcoming trade mission is quickly approaching. An agribusiness trade mission to Bogota, Colombia is coming up August 13th through the 15th. Since the implementation of the U.S.-Colombia Trade Promotion Agreement in 2012, U.S. ag exports to Colombia have surged by 237%, reaching a record $3.7 billion in 2023. Changes in Colombian lifestyle, such as the rise of dual-income households and increased demand for healthier and packaged foods, present favorable opportunities for U.S. exporters. The mission will facilitate meetings between U.S. agribusiness representatives and potential Colombian importers, along with market briefings and networking events. The Colombian market offers opportunities for a wide range of U.S. exports, including fresh fruit, meat products, dairy, and various other food items. Applications for participation in the trade mission are being accepted until May 3rd. A requirement under the Clean Truck Check program has been pushed back. Director of Regulatory and Environmental Affairs for Western United Dairies, Paul Souza, explained the latest action by the California Air Resources Board.
The requirement for smog checks had been moved from July of 2024 to January of 2025. They are delaying the smog check requirement. For some reason, the program is not ready to go yet, and so truck and fleet owners don't have to worry about getting their truck smogged until at least January of 2025, and it's possible that they move that date again if they're not quite ready. However, there are a couple of deadlines that have passed and continue to be there for this rule, and those deadlines do stick. So there was a deadline to register each of your trucks in an ARB database and pay a $30 fee per truck, and that deadline is January 31st of 2024. That was for the 2023 calendar year that you paid that $30 fee and registered those trucks in the database. That's going to happen again in 2024. You need to pay the $30 fee per truck depending on the truck's registration date, and those requirements and deadlines do stand. If you have not met that deadline, they are putting registration holds on those trucks in 2024. So if you haven't done that, you get your registration in the mail from DMV. It says you're not eligible to renew the registration on this truck because of an ARB hold, and it would be because you didn't put it in the database and paid the $30 fee.
UC Cooperative Extension's offering a series of workshops to help growers manage irrigation and nutrients for young and immature orchards. The workshops will feature presentations by various experts and researchers covering almonds, pistachios, walnuts, olives, and citrus. The first workshop is scheduled for May 9th in Modesto, followed by May 14th in Merced. Growers, certified crop advisors, and other agricultural professionals are encouraged to attend. The final two workshops in the series will be held on May 22nd in Fresno and June 5th in Bakersfield. Speakers will be highlighting the best irrigation and nutrient management practices tailored specifically for young orchards in the San Joaquin Valley, helping to ensure healthier tree development, better resource utilization, and more resilient orchards in the face of climate change. More information about the workshops is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
A successful trade mission to India. That's coming up on This Land of Ours.
In just a few years, India could be a huge potential buyer of U.S. food and ag products.
And I think we see that with just a few days here in India.
USDA Undersecretary for Trade Alexis Taylor this week leading a U.S. trade mission in India, a nation of 1.4 billion people. But at the moment,
we send around 1% of our food and ag exports to India. That, I think, we way underperform.
But Taylor says the time is right to begin to turn that around because
by 2030, 66 million people in India will be in middle class and upper middle class households. That's a lot of purchasing power. And if we can get in now and develop taste for American food and agricultural products, we can have lifelong consumers of those products. So I think it's a really exciting market.
A market starting to open up. Last year, India reduced tariffs on 10 U.S. food and ag products. Taylor says that's one reason for the trade mission this year. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The mission of the U.S. Grains Council is to develop markets, enable trade, improve lives. Chad Smith has more.
Carlos Suarez, Manager of Sustainability, Policy, and Innovation for the U.S. Grains Council, talks about how USGC incorporates sustainability into the mission.
Incorporating sustainability is something recent in terms of the actual work that the Grains Council does in its international program. Sustainability has been ingrained in U.S. corn production for decades, and so what we've begun to do is to work on, number one, preventing that sustainability becomes a market access barrier across the countries in which we operate, but more importantly, that we align with our customers in terms of what they are requiring in relation to sustainability, in particularly showcasing how U.S. corn origin can help them meet those requirements.
He talks about how the council addresses concerns related to sustainability.
In particular, we see the key performance indicators that the U.S. Grains Council references, which is Field to Market's National Indicators Report. And we see that, for example, water usage since the 1980s has been reduced by over 56%, land use around 44%, and then greenhouse gases by 48%. So what the Grains Council does is internationally communicate and showcase to our customers how the different regulations, enforcement, and best practices that underpin U.S. production and U.S. corn origin are the ones that allow for this superb environmental performance.
Suarez says innovation and technology play a big role in advancing sustainability goals in the grain industry.
Biotechnology has been a central component of that effort, allowing for the implementation of reduced tillage and a decrease in the use of pesticides across the whole of the U.S. corn industry. Technology also means using nature-based solutions, which corn farmers have been doing as they drive up their efforts to implement cover cropping wherever that is possible. This improves soil health and increases soil organic capture sequestration. And so every day we see more and more our farmers implementing this type of practices. The ever more innovative technologies such as satellite guidance systems to work fields, variable rate fertilizer, and crop protection product application.
He looks ahead to the U.S. Grains Council's plans and initiatives relating to sustainability.
What we see is an ever-growing appetite to work with the council around satisfying sustainability requirements, being able to measure and quantify how U.S. corn production is sustainable, because we know that sustainability is there. And so we will continue to work with our stakeholders to align with the international sustainability framework, ensure fulfill that mission to develop markets and enable trade for which the U.S. Grains Council is famous for, and that ultimately results in improving lives, not only in the U.S., but across the international supply chains, in which we know that U.S. corn can contribute to and be leveraged by our users.
For more information on the U.S. Grains Council's sustainability efforts, go to grains.org. Chad Smith reporting.
We've been talking a lot about trade today. Well, the U.S. Trade Representative recently provided updates and examples of how agricultural export opportunities are developed and expanded for our nation's food and farm products. Rod Bain reports.
Recent visits with lawmakers allowed U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai opportunity to discuss our nation's continued efforts to expand farm and food export markets. She starts with efforts being made within the framework of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement.
Separately, through the USMCA, we are actively championing the interests of our farmers and agricultural producers. We have pursued two cases now against Canada's dairy tariff rate quota allocation measures, and we are currently in the midst of challenging Mexico's restrictive measures on biotech corn before a panel. We are actively pursuing litigation with Mexico using the tools of the USMCA precisely to address what we consider to be an illegitimate and unscientifically based restriction on our trade in biotech corn to Mexico.
Ambassador Tai also acknowledged the importance of building rural economies through increased ag trade opportunities.
Through negotiations, our administration has secured over $21 billion in new agricultural market access in the last 3 years.
Such as increased farm and food exports in markets like India, through negotiated tariff eliminations and reductions.
After the U.S. and India terminated 7 disputes at the WTO last year, India also agreed to remove retaliatory tariffs on several U.S. products. This means improved access for chickpeas, lentils, almonds, walnuts, and apples, benefiting farmers across the country, including Michigan, Oregon, California, and Washington. This means more market access for turkey, duck, blueberries, and cranberries, benefiting our farmers in North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Massachusetts, and Minnesota.
She also sees the importance of trade-building programs such as USDA's Regional Agricultural Promotion Program as a means to grow ag export opportunities in developing nations.
It is about sharing with the rest of the world the bounty that our incredibly hardworking and savvy farmers produce, and also diversifying our relationships with the markets around the world.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The Association of Equipment Manufacturers will host the Modern Ag on the Mall event next month in Washington, D.C. Michael Clements reports.
As the Farm Bill remains front and center for U.S. agriculture, AEM is showcasing the latest farm equipment for the public and policymakers. Kurt Blades, AEM Senior Vice President of Agriculture, says it's a great way to tell the story of modern agriculture.
For the second time in the last 3 years, we're pleased to be hosting a celebration of modern agriculture on the National Mall. This really provides an opportunity for those of us in the ag industry to tell the story to lawmakers and policymakers and the general public about what is happening happening in modern agriculture and the difference that it's making in producing food and fiber and fuel for a growing world.
The celebration of modern ag on the National Mall takes place the week of May 6th, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. It's open 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. every day. Blade says there are multiple target audiences for the event.
Our first audience is an audience of about 50 to 200 people. And those are those folks that are really involved with writing public policies that are really impacting agriculture. The secondary audience is also very exciting, and that's the general public. That might be hill staffers or just general public that are walking through the mall. So we love to be able to tell those stories. Tractors and combines and pieces of equipment are pretty good eye candy and a pretty good way to lure people in to tell that story.
Michael Clements reporting.
This is the AgNet News Hour, and we will be back in just a moment with more agricultural news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Here's Cindy Zimmerman with the Ethanol Report.
The entire ethanol industry was pleased to see the emergency waiver issued by the Environmental Protection Agency this past week to allow uninterrupted nationwide sales of E15 through the summer. I talked with the Renewable Fuels Association Senior Vice President for Government and Public Affairs, Troy Bradenkamp, to get their reaction.
Yeah, we had very welcome news from the EPA. They have issued the emergency waiver for E15 for this coming summer driving season. E15 is not available for sale usually because of a vapor pressure issue during June 1st to September 15th. The last 5 or 6 years, we have been able to maintain some year-round sale of E15, mostly through emergency waivers. And the Biden administration looked at the criteria that needed to be met and realized that there are issues going on all over the world. Geopolitical unrest continues in Europe. There's obviously situations that are developing in the Middle East, and all of that could lead to a supply issue over this summer. And so they felt that they needed to get a little bit ahead of that, and they issued emergency waivers that would allow for summertime sale of E15 for this summer driving season. So very good news, not only for consumers, because they're going to have access to the lowest cost fuel at the pump, but it's also a good news story because E15 is cleaner burning and all those other things. And it won't disrupt the supply chain by actually having those E15 blends not available this summer. So very much welcome news. Of course, the ultimate goal here, though, is to find a permanent solution to this. While we certainly appreciate the Biden administration's issuance of the summertime waiver, we are certainly seeking some sort of permanent legislative solution that will help resolve this issue long-term for E15 so that we don't have to keep begging and pleading to make sure that E15 does not disappear during the summer.
Well, a couple of months ago, we were hoping this might not even be necessary if EPA would approve the petition by 8 states to allow year-round sales of E15. But since that's been delayed until next year, the ethanol industry has been pushing EPA to once again grant these waivers to maintain consistency in the fuel supply for retailers and consumers and the ethanol industry, right?
So you are correct. The 8 Midwest states that petitioned the EPA to opt out of the RVP program were granted that, but it was delayed until 2025. And so those 8 states were certainly in need of some kind of an emergency waiver to get through this summer driving season, but also the other 42 states, you know, would not have had access to E15 if there was any being sold within those states. And some of those, you start looking outside of that 8-state area, there's some significant E15 sales going on. And so ironically, we would have probably needed an emergency waiver for the other 42 states, even if those 8 Midwest states had been given this RVP opt-out and it had it been effective this summer driving season. So there's just a lot of balls in the air. Again, this all points to the need for permanent legislative resolution to this issue. It's there in a bill that's been introduced not only in the Senate in S-2707, but we're also working to get a bill introduced in the House so that we can permanently and in a forever way, you know, resolve this issue so that consumers have certainty, the industry would have certainty, retailers that are looking to adopt E15 and to install the infrastructure needed to utilize E15, they would have certainty. All of that is what's required, and the federal legislation is what would make that happen.
So you're saying if we don't have a permanent solution by next summer, we would have to have waivers again for those other 42 states, or else would that mean they have to have different types of fuel for different areas then?
It would make it a challenge. There is no doubt about that, which is why we've been working very closely with the American Petroleum Institute, which is the largest trade organization for oil and gas companies and refineries. They realize that that 8-state opt-out is not ideal for them. I think they understand why it was what was asked for by those 8 states. But you're right, it would require a different base fuel, a lower volatilization fuel to be utilized and be brought into those states during the summer. So again, if you had harmonization across the country by having year-round E15 resolved, then that would be a far better solution and a far better position for our supply chain, so that there isn't disruption or there's no bottlenecks or anything like that. So yes, that's again speaking to the need for a federal legislative fix.
All right, well then tell us more about the Nationwide Consumer and Fuel Retailer Choice Act and where we are with that.
So we continue to push to make sure that the legislative solution to E15, which is S-2707, the Nationwide Consumer and Fuel Retailer Choice Act, is adopted by Congress as soon as possible. We have run into a little bit of a roadblock in Senator Carper of Delaware. He is chairman of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. He has a refinery in his state that is not supportive of getting year-round E15 resolved. And so he has made it clear to us that until that refiner is satisfied with whatever compromise language we might come up with, that he's not going to support it. So that's where we're at. We're trying to work ways around that issue with him. We're trying to make sure that Midwest Democrat colleagues of his are weighing in and are expressing to him the need to get this permanent solution passed and resolved. So that's ongoing. We're hopeful that something will break loose here. It may actually be an end of the year strategy. And now that we have an emergency waiver process in place for this summer driving season, that takes a little bit of the urgency and the pressure off, at least to get it done immediately. But it doesn't resolve the issue long term. So that's why we would be still looking to get something done and to make sure 2707 gets over the finish line. We're also talking to supporters on the House side, because as you know, you need a companion bill over there. And so we're working to try and figure out what that looks like and make sure that we're coordinating with them and they're coordinating with the Senate so that when and if we can get some kind of a final compromise agreed to by all parties, then it's ready to go and it could be acted upon and passed in a relatively short manner. But in order to get there, you have to do a lot of background information. You got to do some pre-work in order to make that happen. That's the phase that we're in right now.
And isn't Senator Carper retiring at the end of the year?
Senator Carper is retiring, which is another reason why we were under kind of the false impression that he might actually be willing to compromise more than he has at least indicated so far. He is still pretty dug in for his constituent. And unfortunately, that has not waned a lot, even with his pending retirement. So we'll wait and see. I think that's another reason why a lot of folks are pointing toward maybe an end of year strategy, potentially even going past the election date. So think lame duck. So maybe even a lame duck strategy that might be employed here, because at that point, there's a lot of folks that think, well, Senator Carper really doesn't have a whole lot left on the docket before he retires. Maybe this is one of those issues that he would like to have resolved on his watch. So we'll have to wait and see. But that's kind of the scenario that we're following right now.
Well, on the House side, we did see Representative Nunn from Iowa this past week introduce a bill that I assume is going nowhere at this point, since it was to only allow sales of E15 in those 8 states this summer, since they're going to have them next summer. But as far as the longer term is concerned, are you looking at some of the lawmakers who signed on to that bill as possibly helping out with this effort?
Oh, absolutely. And we appreciate Representative Nunn and those that supported that effort, simply because we understand where they're at. They want a permanent solution to this issue as well. They're raising awareness, but at the end of the day, it did only impact those 8 states, or it would only impact those 8 states if it was to be approved, and it's got a very small likelihood of ever getting final passage. But it does speak to the need to get a nationwide permanent solution, and everyone that signed on to that package is supportive of a permanent solution as well. So we appreciate the effort. The real focus here has to remain on a 50-state strategy, which is a federal legislative fix that works in every state and allows for E15 to be sold year-round.
Thank you once again to Cindy Zimmerman. That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.